Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I don't know if you're continuing to watch the NFL football playoffs, Amy, now that the Bears are out, but...
Yeah, that Saints game was awesome.
So a bear giveth to the Eagles and Cody Parkey. And a bear taketh away in Alshon Jeffrey.
I know. Yeah. Sorry. Don't drop the pass, man.
Did you see one Cody Parkey on the Today Show on Friday morning?
I did not. Yeah. I know that people tried to relive the moment and kick
the Goose Island thing.
Yeah. And out of 101 participants, not one even came close.
Granted,
it was snowing outside.
There were a couple, at least from the video I saw, that came close. But yeah, it was pretty slippery. I would say that Cody Parkey had a much better field of play than did the folks at Goose Island.
And also, too, was that supposed to be their offensive line there, the people behind the gate, that they had to kick over to get through?
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right. It's supposed to be, right, this is the trajectory you have to hit in order to prevent it from being blocked. So nobody won the Goose Island Challenge. But Parkey is getting a lot of heat for this appearance on the Today Show.
Why, because he did it in the first place? People were shocked that he was... I know that people were saying, why would he even do that? I said, because he's probably getting paid, and why not?
Well, I don't know if he's getting paid. But why did he do that? I think, okay, that's a fair question, I suppose. I think part of it is Savannah Guthrie didn't help him out much, because she was just over the top and effusive in defense of Cody Parkey. But here's what he had to say. You know, football, just what he does, not who he is.
The reason you're here and the reason we're so excited to talk to you is because of the kind of person that you are and everything you did after that kick.
Friends.
But I have to ask you what you were thinking, you know, what in that moment and in your mind, did you know it had been tipped? Like, what was going through your mind?
No, you know, as a kicker, you know, you live for those moments. And I was 3 for 3 before that. I had a lot of confidence going into that kick. So I went out there and, my long snapper and holder did a great job, and you know, I saw the wind moving a little bit. I said, all right, this is where I'm going to play it. And obviously, I didn't know it was tipped or anything. I just went down, and I thought I hit a pretty good kick, you know, felt good off my foot, and then looking up, and then I saw it hit the upright, and then hit the crossbar, and I'm like, surely it'll go in. unfortunately, bounced towards me, but obviously, I'm disappointed, that I let the fans, my teammates, and the whole organization down, but I'll continue to keep my head held high because football is what I do. It's not who I am.
Very serious approach.
Yeah, he...
What was in your mind?
He also talked about the prayer because Savannah Guthrie asked him, or one of the girls asked him, what about
ladies, Dan. Yeah. They're called ladies.
Yeah. There's a maturation level you have to reach to be considered a lady. Prayer after the game. So he misses it, and then he looks up to the... You know, points up to the sky, and... One of the ladies asked him about that.
So something I've always tried to do is, through good or bad, you know, give praise to the higher power, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And after the game, one of the coolest things, in my opinion, is just the prayer that we do, because you get done battling the other team for 60 minutes, and we all join in prayer. And it's just, we're just praying for safety and health, and that the team gets home safely on their plane and stuff like that. So it's really encouraging stuff, and it's something I look forward to.
I have a team getting home safely on the plane story. So my friend was in Cancun. Listen to this. And the Cowboys had taken that same 787 from L.A. after their loss to Chicago, Cancun. It was delayed for an hour because they completely trashed the plane after they lost the game. Completely trashed it. Wine and things on the wall in the bathroom. Carpet was trashed. So the Cowboys, I think they got home safely after their game.
Okay.
And trashed a plane in the way and told everybody it was mechanical error.
Well,
there was a mechanical error. That's why they were delayed. And it was just because the Cowboys were on the plane and trashed it.
Well, Cody and his wife, Colleen,
yes,
didn't take a plane from the game.
But they did drive to Florida where they live.
They drove?
Drove to Florida. And Colleen then was in studio.
Oh, come on over. Did they invite her on the set?
She was mic'd up, and they threw to her and asked her, Colleen, how, from her perspective, you know, what she thinks of her husband. Is she going to get a divorce?
Colleen is in our studio, too. Hey, Colleen. So you were witnessing, what your husband went through. What do you think of this guy?
Oh my gosh. I could not be more proud of him. Obviously, like he said,
well, he could be more proud.
The kick didn't go in, and we're getting through that. But just watching his character and everything shine through, which obviously stands above football in my eyes. So I'm super proud of him.
It's nice to have a supportive wife, I suppose.
They drove to Florida?
Yeah, they drive to Florida. And they said didn't talk much about the game other than, don't hit that post.
Oh, hey, oh.
But here's where it got a little syrupy, a little too treacly for some Chicago sports writers. Savannah Guthrie closing it out.
They have MVPs. I think they should have MHP, most honorable player. Yeah. You really, really showed what you're made of.
Can we get that vomit sound out?
I mean, Cody, yeah, well, I mean, that's okay, a standard right, issue I, on I'm, the Today Show.
I'm okay.
Cody Parkey was off target again in whatever he was trying to accomplish with his Today interview. This is Dan Weider and Rich Campbell writing in the Chicago Tribune. I mean, they spent, this is a transcript of their back and forth, but I mean, they spent about 1,500 words torching Cody Parkey for doing this interview. I mean, he seems like a very nice kid. They seem like a lovely young couple. He missed the kick, but he had a spotty season, be honest. But I mean, I wasn't offended by that Today Show appearance.
Oh, it was sweet.
You know, I mean, it's one of these things where why did he do it in the first place? Should he just go into hiding, be a recluse, and not speak to the outside world until there's been time to forgive him for his sins? I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of interested to hear from him. That's not the best Chicago Bears video, though.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about.
Oh, really? What do you think it is?
Tariq Cohen. Embracing Judaism. Awesome. Everybody has got to see this video.
This was great. So Tariq Cohen sits down with Lefko and Sims, or Sims and Lefko, I think it's actually. Yeah. Sims and Lefko.
Crofton Jacobson.
So that's former NFL quarterback Chris Sims, right? Had a stint with the Bears. Phil Sims' kid.
He went to Morehead State.
They sit down with the joystick, Tariq Cohen, at Sarge's Deli in New York City, and Lefko explains why.
When I heard there was a guy in the NFL, Sims, named Tariq Cohen, yes. I said, L'chaim, we've got ourselves finally a Jewish running back. And then I found out not only have you never been to a bar mitzvah, not only have you never had Jewish food, you're not Jewish.
Sadly, no.
I appreciate
no.
the sadly.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So they give him, they lay out the full Jewish food experience. Oh,
really? I am 100% Jewish.
Yeah.
What I want to give to you is the full Jewish experience. I can call it a Jewish combine to making you feel like a true Jewish man. Are you ready to take this journey with me?
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely ready.
Okay.
L'chaim.
It's getting into the swing of it, Tariq. Is first dish?
This is our first dish. This is a customary Jewish breakfast. Do you want to take a guess as to what is in front of you right now?
Sushi.
It is not sushi. It is smoked salmon. What do you think?
Cream cheese and fish.
Exactly.
Man.
Yes, man is right.
All right, so don't be afraid of it.
No, I'm not.
So why don't you pick it up?
Oh, that was a, oh my gosh.
Hold on.
I don't like it.
Was he allowed to spit it out if he didn't like it?
The bagel and lox did not sit well with Tariq Cohen. Second dish.
This is a Jewish deli staple. And it's not just what it is, it's the size of it. Okay?
Yeah.
This is a pastrami on rye. And do you see how much meat is on there?
Yeah.
That's not just special.
A little excessive.
Can't miss it.
He looked at that like it was a blitzing linebacker when it came in. He like literally looked at it and was like...
Why don't you bite into that?
All right, let's see which one.
And this is part of the process, too. The strategy of how to bite the sandwich.
I can see that.
So I'm going to go ahead and try to flatten him.
Nice. I think he's going to like this.
You think he'll like it?
I feel pretty confident about it.
I really give him credit for having guts to just dive in there, though.
Why is there no cheese and nothing on it, though? Cheese, mayonnaise, or something?
Well, that wouldn't be kosher.
It's getting the full Jewish experience and a little bit of tutelage.
That's awesome.
The third dish.
We have one more. This is the Cadillac of Jewish food. Tariq Cohen, I'd like to introduce you to your new favorite food, matzah ball soup.
Matzah ball.
He's never had matzah ball soup.
Have you heard of matzah balls before?
Mozzarella.
Mozzarella, not the same thing. This is not cheese.
There's no cheese in there?
There's no cheese. You thought matzah balls had cheese too?
I totally did.
So the best way to do this is to take your spoon, take a little piece of the matzah ball, get a little bit of soup in there.
Oh, it's soft.
It's very soft. And there it is.
Oh, that's good.
That's the 10.
It's like chicken noodle soup, really.
It's chicken noodle soup.
All right, they like the matzo ball soup. Not so hot on the pastrami or the
salmon,
bagels and lox.
Which you thought was sushi. Yeah, it was sushi. Smoked sushi.
And then they went on to give Tariq Cohen a little bit of a vocabulary lesson, some words that he can use in the locker room from, the Jewish experience.
So here's the first word.
This is going to be fun.
It is.
Schmooze.
Schmooze. What do you think schmooze means?
Good sleep.
Good sleep. Oh, like a schmooze.
I'm going to go schmooze.
I'm going to go schmooze. So a schmooze is actually to like kind of talk somebody up.
Hey, I like your play calls, Matt Nagy. That's a really good one. You're
throw
schmoozing
the ball.
Him, so he gives you the ball.
Okay. Yeah. You schmooze, you win.
Right.
Next word. Ooh. Good luck saying this one.
Chutzpah.
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 All right, so you got to get a...
Chutzpah.
Oh.
We were in the team meeting, and Tariq Cohen stood up and said, I don't like that play. Tariq's got a lot of chutzpah.
Like balls.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is the Jewish slang phrase of all generations.
Oy vey.
Oy vey. What do you think it is?
Tariq Cohen was supposed to run the slant route, and he ran the go route. Oy vey, Tariq Cohen.
Or it's like, all those pickles for me? Oy vey.
Oh, yeah, I got you. So it's good and bad.
It could be everything.
Yeah. So he's picking up on it. Right, yeah, he's picking up on it. And because Tariq Cohen was a good sport.
This is a part I saw.
Yeah.
They picked him up in a chair.
Well, they did that, but they also gave him a little parting gift.
Oh.
You have aced the Jewish combine, and I have a gift for you.
Oy vey.
Oy vey. I give you a Chicago Bears yarmulke.
It's a Jewish fitted cap.
A Jewish fitted cap, yes. Oh, my gosh, it looks so beautiful.
A Jewish fitted cap. Is
oh, my gosh, it looks so beautiful. Tariq Cohen, yeah, and then they did the Hava Nagila.
Yeah,
it was good. So Tariq Cohen was a great sport. I thought Cody Parkey was a pretty good sport, too. A little bit different.
They're showing their personalities to the country.
Bear down, Chicago Bears fans.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So now we've set the record. It's the longest partial government shutdown, temporary furlough of non-essential workers in United States history.
24 days and counting.
Mm-hmm. President Trump is not going to give, and President Trump has said that. He's said that if no reasonable deal can be reached that includes border wall funding, that DACA is on the table, a pathway for Dreamers on the table. Those seem to be on the table. But according to Lindsey Graham, who was on with Chris Wallace, Fox News Sunday, Pelosi isn't interested in any of it. And so what's the president to do? Fold? I don't think so.
I tried to see if we could open up the government for a limited period of time to negotiate a deal. And the president says, let's make a deal, then open up the government. Nancy Pelosi says, even if you opened up the government, I wouldn't fund a wall. So that's why I'm depressed. You know, there's not much talk about what she said. She's telling the president, even if you open up the government, I'm not going to do a deal on the wall. And that's a non-starter for the president.
And Lindsey Graham providing the nation with a little bit of a history lesson again on Democrats' past behavior.
Every Democrat that I've worked with for about 10 years now has agreed to funding for barriers slash walls on Obama's watch, on Bush's watch, and all of a sudden it's a bad thing on Trump's watch. It really does perplex me how you expect this to end when you tell the President of the United States you can't get it. You get $1 for a wall when in the past Democrats have appropriated billions for the wall. What is he supposed to do? Just give in? He's not going to give in.
And should he give in if the Democrats are going to make him their bete noire for the purpose of scoring political points or attempting to, while they walk away from the posture they've taken in the past with, as Lindsey Graham mentioned, both Republican and Democrat presidents?
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I mean, Lindsey Graham's plan, opening up the government, he did have a little bit of a solution.
I would urge him to open up the government for a short period of time, like 3 weeks, before he pulls the plug, see if we can get a deal. If we can, at the end of 3 weeks, all bets are off.
Well, but then you heard him go on to say, couching that, say, but Pelosi's already said that approach is DOA because I'm not going to move. I'm not even willing to have a discussion on it. So open the government, don't open the government. I bet my position doesn't change.
That's why Graham went on to say,
what is the president supposed to do? Just unilaterally surrender? By the way, some perspective on the cost here, because these numbers don't mean a lot to people. We're talking about billions of dollars and multi-trillion dollar budget. Just so you get this, the $5.7 billion out of a $4 trillion budget, that represents about $17 per United States citizen. So, again, this is not a money thing.
No.
Especially you should know this because the Democrats are all of a sudden have eschewed their spendthrift ways and they're worried about every nickel in the federal coffer. Hardly. And it's also not a concern about the most effective way to secure the border, because what is the harm? Let's say you don't believe that the wall will be effective in any way, which is sort of absurd on its face. A barrier presents, a barrier. But let's just say you believe that. What's the harm exactly? Oh, it's a symbol to the free world that America is xenophobic or some such thing. Well, then how do you address the barriers that other countries put on their borders?
Right. Well, some people argue, well, in Europe they don't have walls. Yeah, but this isn't Europe.
Actually,
they do in certain places,
yes.
Right. But if you wanted to move freely between Spain, other countries, you can. But this is a completely different situation.
Well, right. You can move freely through the EU the same way you can move freely through the United States.
Yep.
That's the actual comparison. Tim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I had a question. Isn't it going to get to a tipping point to where it's going to cost more than a $5 billion just by having it closed?
Well,
don't you understand that it's costing us money?
Well,
right
I mean, it's costing us money in terms of what, GDP? I mean,
we're going to have to furlough all these checks, so you're basically paying people for not working. So,
well, right.
That's the
work product you're not getting if you believe that that work product has substantial market value. Right, you're going to be paying people for not working. That's true, but again, that prompts the question that Lindsey Graham essentially put to the nation on Wallace yesterday, which is, what should the president do if the Democrats are unwilling to do what they've done before, or even talk about doing what they've done before, and some approximation of it? Is he supposed to unilaterally surrender on the issue?
No, if he surrenders, basically his chances of reelection are over at that point.
I think that's right.
What if he declares a national emergency, though? Can he still get the wall built? Because I heard a lot of people squawking over the weekend that even if he declares a national emergency, there's no guarantee that Army Corps of Engineers would build it. They'd have to, right?
No, we're not going to. Okay, well, then I'm going to replace the people that work for the Army Corps of Engineers. Yeah, I don't think that's the issue. And by the way, on that score and the president's legal power to do so, mm-hmm. we talked to Obama's former Customs and Border Protection head, Mark Morgan, last week. he supports Trump's plan, even though he was replaced by Trump. He says what Trump is saying is absolutely correct. Jay Johnson, Obama's former Department of Homeland Security secretary, was on Face the Nation. And he begrudgingly, even though he's not supportive of the approach that the president is taking, begrudgingly admitted that what the president is talking about with respect to the invocation of National Emergency Act and repurposing money from civilian, domestic civilian projects to the wall has legal standing.
Now, when it comes legally to whether or not the president can declare a national emergency to get around the dispute, earlier in the week, the administration seemed to be talking about using a Department of Defense authority to take money that's been designated by Congress for military construction toward another project. The law specifically allows for that upon the declaration of a national emergency, but that particular provision is typically used overseas to support the military, like building detention facilities or military housing. The lawyers in the administration now seem to have come to a provision that allows for a reprogramming, as we refer to it, taking money from Army civil works projects here in the United States that were at some point essential to national defense, and then redesignating it, reprogramming it for some other Army civil works project.
Some of that aid money for Puerto Rico and money for California.
In my view, that's probably slightly more legally plausible. The earlier defense authority was really trying to jam a square peg in a round hole. Mm-hmm. This one is slightly more plausible, but politically highly objectionable because you're taking billions of dollars away from important civil works projects to recover from the hurricanes and the wildfires. And I would predict there'd be huge, huge objection.
Well, that may be so. And the political discussion and the political disagreement is one matter. But as a matter of law, Jay Johnson is essentially conceding the point. Now, Ron Johnson, no relation.
No relation.
Yeah. Senator from Wisconsin, north of the Cheddar Curtain there. He was on with Tapper, and he's got a proposal, too, and he's got an idea. And he didn't go so far as to say he wouldn't back the president's play on invocation of national emergency powers, but he hopes it doesn't come to that.
Would you support President Trump declaring a national emergency to be able to fund his border wall?
A better solution would be to pass our Shutdown Fairness Act, which is going to pay those individuals that are being forced to work because they're essential. So I've got a piece of legislation. Got about five co-sponsors already. We'll introduce it tomorrow, but it'll actually pay those workers that Senator Warner's concerned about. So hopefully Mitch McConnell will bring that up. Hopefully Democrats will support it. Hopefully President Trump can sign it so at least those individuals get paid.
Okay, but beyond that, assuming that the shutdown still continues, would you support President Trump, yes or no, declaring a national emergency?
I would hate to see it. You know, using that act, it would be, in this instance, would be a far larger act than has ever occurred in the past. So I'd prefer not, primarily because if we do that, it's going to go to court and the wall won't get built. So I actually want to see this wall get built. And so I want to keep pressure on Democrats to actually come to the negotiating table in good faith and fund what they've supported in the past.
So that's, again, the Republicans repeating and reminding people, as well they should, of the history of Democrats supporting funding for border security, including physical barriers under Republican and Democrat presidents of recent past, of $4 billion under Obama. Ron Johnson brought up those paychecks.
Yeah.
Some data, Wall Street Journal over the weekend, on the nomenclatura.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I think he was my English professor junior year.
Mr. Nomenclatura?
Nomenclatura, yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah.
Tough grade.
It was really hard to get. I squeaked by with an A minus.
Metropolitan area federal workers earn on average 50% more than non-federal workers, according to 2017 data from the Labor Department. 50%. The biggest difference in El Paso, where federal employees can earn on average double what non-federal employees earn. In Huntsville, Alabama, federal employees earn on average 85% more than non-federal workers. And remember, the number one employer in Chicago Metro, the biggest employer?
Government.
Federal government.
Federal government. Oh, excuse me.
Number one with a bullet. Government generally, but federal government specifically. Okay. There are more than 18,000 federal workers in San Fran. But in a city offering many high-paying jobs, the average pay for a federal worker is just 2% higher than the average for other workers. Well, that is a remarkable statement.
Oh, my God.
In San Fran, where what's the median home price? Almost $1 million.
$1.2 million?
Yeah, or maybe it's over a million now.
For a studio?
The average federal worker pay is 2% higher.
Ooh.
The journal goes on to provide some context, which is fair to say. Overall, federal workers tend to be older, more educated, more concentrated in professional occupations than those in the private sector. 60% of the federal workforce has at least a bachelor's degree compared with 35% in the private sector. But let me suggest something on that. Two things, actually. One is, yeah, okay. Is it possible that the public sector overvalues a college degree or even advanced degrees with respect to particular professions? You know, it's sort of how teachers automatically negotiated in collective bargaining agreements get an increase if they go to get their master's degree. Well, have you become a better teacher? Are you adding the value to the student outcomes that the associated salary would suggest? Because there's no market test, right? So it's just what one commissar suggests for another commissar to lift the salaries of all the commissars. That's number one. Number two, I've seen other data on federal versus the rest of the workforce in a particular locale. And even when you adjust for education and you compare similar professions in the private sector versus the public sector, you've got federal workers, and it's certainly the case at the state level in places like Illinois, that are still 10 to 15% higher than their private sector counterparts, controlling for education, controlling for cost of living, controlling for professional responsibilities, 10 to 15% higher before you get to the gold-plated pension and health care benefits as compared to the private sector. Just something to consider when you hear a lot of the tales of woe across this population. And maybe, and again, people should be paid for the work that they do. Okay, that's first principle. But maybe this is an opportunity for a little bit of education of the public in terms of what exactly we're paying versus what people are making in the private sector financing all of this. And a recalibration is in order, like Trump actually has initiated by freezing federal salaries, which is a good start.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
So, more reality TV news there. Big Brother Celebrity Edition released its cast for the season.
Yeah.
And it includes the Mooch.
Scaramucci. Well, I thought Sean Spicer was on it.
I know. I don't see him on the list now. Did he back out and did the Mooch backfill?
Ayo.
I don't know.
I don't know, but Tanya Harding, she was on this leaked list. Caitlyn Jenner, I doubt that.
Ryan Lochte.
Oh my, seriously, this is a dream list. Somebody got released that.
Kato Kaelin. He never gets old.
I love his hair.
Kato Kaelin, Lindsay Lohan's mom.
What?
You got that. You got your Joey Lawrence, teen heartthrob Joey Lawrence.
Stephen Baldwin. I mean, this has got to be a joke, right?
Ricky
can't
Williams.
Have this much power.
Former NFL running back Ricky Williams. Hopefully, he will not wear a wedding dress.
Really?
I think Ditka should be on with Ricky Williams since he gave away like 10 years of Saints draft picks to get Ricky Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Winner. I don't know. I've never watched this.
I have never. The only time I watched it was just to make sure that Julie Chen Moonves was okay.
Oh, yeah, right. She's the host.
The host. I'm surprised that she hasn't backed out yet.
The winner.
Maybe they'll throw her husband in there.
The winner gets a grand prize of $250,000, which will go to pay off the sexual harassment claims against Julie Chen's husband, I believe.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So last week, New York City Mayor, comrade Bill de Blasio proposed a city provision of health insurance to all New York City denizens. Oh. You know, you've got a lot of this going on now with the socialists that are ascendant in places like New York, California, Washington State. They're going to try and do what Vermont abandoned, which is go to single payer locally. Go to government run and financed health insurance completely, crowd private insurance out of the market. Brothers and sisters, there's plenty of money in the world. There's plenty of money in this city. It's just in the wrong hands. Brothers and sisters, there's plenty of money in the world. There's plenty of money in the city. It's just in the wrong hands, said de Blasio. And as I will remind you, if it's uttered in New York, it echoes through the halls of power in Chicago. We'll be coming here shortly. Yep. So tomorrow, all the Chicago mayoral candidates sit before the Tribune editorial board.
Ooh.
I wonder.
I hope they're all going to show up.
Oh, well, that's
Tony Preckwinkle.
That's a good question, number one. And number two, I hope that an enterprising young reporter or columnist, say Kristen McQuarrie or John Cass, asks the candidates whether or not they agree with de Blasio. There's enough. There's plenty of money in the world. There's plenty of money in the city. It's just in the wrong hands. I mean, you understand what the implication of that statement is, don't you? Bill de Blasio and his apparatchiks have the secret knowledge to take money from the wrong hands, as they define it, and put that money in the right hands, as they define it. They know just how to efficiently calibrate the distribution of the fruits of other people's labor in an 8 million person city like New York. And if you don't think that most of the candidates in Chicago for mayor subscribe to that same theory, then you haven't been paying attention to the mayor's race here. And oh, by the way, the mayor's race here is 45 days away. John Cass calls it in his column over the weekend the most important mayor's race in decades.
Well, of our time. I mean, never again are we going to have this chance. We have 15 different candidates right now to choose from. But normally, if you're the incumbent, you win again and again and again and again. This is a changing of the guard here.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Do you want to know if your governor, your forthcoming Chicago mayor, subscribe to the philosophy of, as Kudlow calls him, the Sandinista mayor of New York City? I mean, it's like the 20th century never happened. And we have to relitigate socialism as to whether it is what Churchill said, the gospel of envy, the creed of ignorance, the philosophy of failure. And it is all those things. So I guess if we have to reset the table, then we have to go back to our old friend Uncle Milt. Uncle Milty. Mm-hmm. Milton Friedman. Listen to Milton Friedman and Phil Donahue. Phil Donahue, you know, he would be like a soft Republican these days. That's how far left the Democrats, socialists have gone. Phil Donahue, Milton Friedman, 1979, 40 years ago, discussing this amid the ravages that socialism and its more exuberant iterations, communism and fascism, inflicted upon the world.
When you see around the globe the maldistribution of wealth, the desperate plight of millions of people in underdeveloped countries, when you see so few haves and so many have-nots, when you see the greed and the concentration of power within, did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism and whether greed's a good idea to run on?
Well, first of all, tell me, is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed? You think Russia doesn't run on greed? You think China doesn't run on greed? What is greed? Of course, none of us are greedy. It's only the other fellow who's greedy. The world runs on individuals pursuing their separate interests. The great achievements of civilization have not come from government bureaus. Einstein didn't construct his theory under order from a bureaucrat. Henry Ford didn't revolutionize the automobile industry that way. In the only cases in which the masses have escaped from the kind of grinding poverty you're talking about, the only cases in recorded history are where they have had capitalism and largely free trade. If you want to know where the masses are worst off, it's exactly in the kinds of societies that depart from that. So that the record of history is absolutely crystal clear that there is no alternative way so far discovered of improving the lot of the ordinary people that can hold a candle to the productive activities that are unleashed by a free enterprise system.
But it seems to reward not virtue as much as ability to manipulate the system.
And what does reward virtue? You think the communist commissar rewards virtue? You think a Hitler rewards virtue? You think, excuse me, if you'll pardon me, do you think American presidents reward virtue? Do they choose their appointees on the basis of the virtue of the people appointed or on the basis of their political clout? Is it really true that political self-interest is nobler somehow than economic self-interest? You know, I think you're taking a lot of things for granted. And just tell me, where in the world you find these angels who are going to organize society for us?
Well,
I don't even trust you to do that.
Friedman was the best. I mean, he was just the best. That is about as good a 2 minutes as you're going to get on the topic. And just a couple of important points to extract from that, because that's something that's lost in this. The obvious is lost. We've gone down this road of believing our political leaders are our betters. In Chicago and Illinois, they have the secret knowledge. And they've destroyed cities like Chicago and states like Illinois. And the response has been more of the same. Okay. Your choice. I mean, if you want to rush headlong... If you want to rush headlong into oblivion, then go ahead.
Well, I don't want to. That's why the one that I trust that I think has Chicago's best interest at heart is Paul Vallis.
Okay.
Because he has a plan, yeah, and he's a little nerdy. I don't care. He does not want... He's not doing this for a popularity contest, just to put it off, you know, as another check it off the bucket list of things to do.
But before we get to the candidates, okay. I mean, let's just sort of take stock a little bit. When you have statements of philosophy like offered by Bill de Blasio, there has to be a competing philosophy presented. And that was the conversation Friedman and Donahue were having. Think about that question that Friedman posed to Donahue. Is political self-interest, which is what all these candidates for mayor, all these mayors and politicians around the country are pursuing, is political self-interest nobler than economic self-interest? Is the politician pursuing his political self-interest to get elected or to seek higher office, is that nobler than the entrepreneur pursuing his economic interest? And which throws off more benefits to society net? That's a really important question. And it's one I don't think is contemplated very often by the electorate generally, certainly by the politicians, because they don't want to be seen for what most of them are, which is pursuers of naked ambition. I mean, that's what Ambrose Bierce, politics, a strife of interests masquerading as a contest of principles. And that's what we have largely in the Chicago mayor's race. Is political self-interest nobler than economic self-interest? It's a great question that's posed by Friedman. Corey in Woodlawn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I was telling this guy that let me on that when I stopped voting Democrat and started voting conservative, the first person I ran into was Milton Friedman. He's always taught us that governments never learn, only people learn. So I have no doubt that socialism is coming to Chicago. But I do agree with Amy. Paul Vallis is probably the best choice because he has brought CPS into the black. Thank you.
Thanks, Corey. Secret Knowledge, there's a great book, just because we kept saying that. Secret Knowledge, great book by David Mamet. Of course, Chicago's very own.
I was going to say that.
Okay, very good.
Don't make me get out my herky hawk I had.
The greatest American playwright of our generation, certainly his generation, last 50 years, at least, he wrote a book called The Secret Knowledge. He is a leftist who was mugged by reality. Really good book to pick up.
The Secret Knowledge.
David Mamet's Secret Knowledge.
And to your point, the Sun-Times previewing the Chicago mayoral candidates tomorrow before the Tribune ad board. Chicago Sun-Times actually released answers from the candidates to the revenue question. Which of the following tax increases or sources of revenue do you favor and why? Chicago casino, dope, LaSalle street tax, commuter tax, property tax.
Don't increase. Say prostitution. Legalizing prostitution.
Not on the list. Municipal sales tax increase, real estate transfer tax increase, video gambling tax.
Oh, my God.
And then anything else you want to throw in. Maybe you want to throw in prostitution.
You don't know. And in California, the new governor is thinking about taxing drinking water.
Yeah, Gavin Newsom. Yeah.
Newsom.
Yeah. Oh,
and by the way, real quick, ancillary issue. His wife does not want to be called First Lady.
Queen?
No. First Partner.
Oh, for
gender neutrality.
Of course.
She said, I can't be the First Lady. I have to be the First Partner because this is a partnership.
Sure. Let me ask you a question, Mrs. Newsom. Is Gavin anatomically correct?
It's
ridiculous. But,
yeah, it is.
So go ahead. Good luck, Gavin Newsom. Good luck, Jay Inslee in Washington State. Good luck, de Blasio in New York, pursuing single payer. The socialists in Vermont couldn't figure it out. But Godspeed. You should see these answers from the candidates, many of whom we've interviewed, as to all these tax increases. And I agree with you about Paul Vallis being like the most substantive candidate. It's not even close. But there is a lot of support for progressive real estate taxes. Susanna.
Oh, yeah. Need more real estate.
You got Bill Daley wants a commuter tax. He's also no property tax increase in year one.
Right.
Which means it'll come
year
in year two.
Year two and year three and year four.
Right.
I like how they do that.
Mendoza with gobbledygook, but she does, she's just focusing on support for a graduated state income tax.
I heard she's just a suck toy for the Democratic Party. She had a party last night because she was being sworn in today as Illinois State Comptroller, what she originally ran for.
Have you seen
a few months ago.
Well, yeah.
Keep that in mind, people.
And you've seen the video of her, right? When Burke introduces her as the next city clerk in 2010.
Oh, yeah. We played that, and she hugs him.
The lady of the hour.
Yes.
And then she says,
sorry, man. Thank you. Wait, we've got a hair. Thank you very much.
Susanna Mendoza, Alderman Burke, you are a true champion of mine. He is really primarily the reason I'm standing here. That's not going to come back to haunt you. Kelly in Lamont, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to talk about Amy's point about how do we reach these people, because obviously the audience that you're talking to today, you're preaching to the choir.
Not totally, but yeah, okay, fair point.
Okay. A colleague of mine at work, she doesn't, there's no way she's going to do research on Milton Friedman, and mm-hmm. she doesn't listen to shows like Donahue. I've listened on YouTube to Milton Friedman talks, and it's amazing, the whole dumbing down of America. She watches The View when she can. Mm-hmm. So how are we going to reach these people, especially, it shames me out in the suburbs, the voting that we do out here.
Yeah.
How are we going to reach those people, if you could talk about that?
Well, Kelly, thanks for the question and the call. I mean, that little two-minute clip I played, the exchange between Friedman and Donahue, I mean, he was no conservative iconoclast. Share it. Hey, you're my friend. You're my family member. You're my professional colleague. Did you ever see this? Check this out. Milton Friedman and Phil Donahue from 40 years ago. You know how the debates are the same? And some of the answers are the same, but we've forgotten them, apparently. I mean, prompt a conversation within your circles of influence by just sharing a two-minute clip. I mean, especially in the digital age, it's so easy to build community around content. So just be a content provider within your circles of influence. Yeah, I know. Unfortunately, not everybody listens to this show. They should. Not everybody's intellectually curious like they should be. Some people have but suffered great intellectual violence at the hands of Joy Behar. I get it. but I mean, just share content. Just share data points. Just share discussions, quick snippet discussions like the Friedman-Donahue exchange. At least prompt people to think. What do you think about that? What do you think about what Milton Friedman said? Does he have a point? What about that question? Is political self-interest as exhibited by politicians more noble than the economic self-interest you are exhibiting by working this job to feed your family and build a better life and all that jazz? I just don't think it's that difficult. But you have to be willing to sort of push the envelope sometime. You can't just passively sit by and say, well, you should listen to this show. You should read this book. And when you know the person's not going to do that, put it before them. Share. Make an interpersonal connection to help somebody make an intellectual connection. Candace in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
Hey, Dan, I'm calling because I heard your thing about Milton Friedman. I thought it was interesting. I was reading this book, Lab Rats, which I just picked up at Barnes & Noble, and it was really interesting because it's kind of a gossip rag on Silicon Valley and all the EEOC laws that they're breaking, and it's a hilarious book. But one of the things that he attacked was Milton Friedman, who I love. However, I do think that he had one point in the book, and he brought up FBI as a case study and all these other crazy Silicon Valley companies and their crazy HR people as examples. And he talked about, like, well, he said that there's B companies like Athletica and certain companies that are capitalists, but they do a little bit more of like a family business and more of a like kind of like what Hewlett-Packard used to be. I'm having a hard time explaining this, but I think what the left now is going to try to do is differentiate and go from investor-based business capitalism to more employee-based capitalism. And I've seen on Twitter where, like, he's virtue signaling to, like, left political leaders and stuff like that to use his book as for notes. So I think it's worthwhile for you to read. Plus, it's you can't really put it down. It's pretty fascinating.
All right.
But I do think the left is going to try to differentiate between the two.
Thanks for the call, Candace. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Ben and Amy. Here's a quote for you. If you put your federal government in charge of the Sahara Desert,
yes,
in 5 years there'd be a shortage of sand. Who said that? Milton Friedman.
Another Friedman classic. Thanks, Bob.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Did you hear about Megyn Kelly? She signed a bye-bye contract with NBC. They $69 million they gave her.
They had to pay her out her guarantee. It's no surprise.
Wow. They were going to fight it, though, I thought. But they, in the end, they didn't find it. Must be nice.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You're tired of a 24-day partial government shutdown? You say Trump and Republicans had an opportunity to get the border barrier funded in their first 2 years. They did. That's fair. But if you're tired of the 24-day partial shutdown, how tired you think the families of victims of persons in this country illegally are for years and years and years, a federal government, both political parties failing to address their first order responsibility, the physical security of their constituents. Both parties take the rhetorical position that of course people in this country illegally who commit violent crimes should be removed. Of course. And yet what steps have been taken to ensure that, as we have another high profile case over the holidays, Raneel Singh, the police officer from California, murdered by a person in this country illegally. This is an exchange between Ted Cruz and Obama's ICE director, Sarah Saldana, from July of 2015. And you tell me what's changed in the intervening 3.5 years.
Ms. Saldana, I want to note that your testimony here, when I ask you how many criminals ICE released in 2013, you were off by a factor of 3. You said 30,000. The correct answer is 104,000. There were 68,000 criminals, criminal illegal aliens, that ICE declined to begin deportation proceedings against, despite the fact, as Senator Sessions observed, the federal law that you're holding up there says they shall be deported. The Obama administration refused to deport them. That's 68,000. In addition to that, there were 36,000 in deportation proceedings with criminal convictions that the Obama administration released. And I would note that among those were 193 murderers with homicide convictions, were 426 people with sexual assault convictions, were over 16,000 criminal illegal aliens with drunk driving convictions released by this administration because this administration refuses to follow the law.
And the party that was that administration continues. Nancy Pelosi was asked about that, Ranil Singh in particular.
Oh, she was.
Briefing she gave on Friday to the assembled press corps, and here's her answer.
Would you say this to families who had lost relatives to heroin overdoses, because obviously the drug 90% of the time came from Mexico? What would you say to families like that?
Well, what I would say to families like that is what I've said to the president regularly. These are tragic situations. There's a tragic situation at the border. Two little children died in the custody of the Border Patrol. But the plural of anecdote is not data. And as painful and horrible, one death is more than we should be able to bear, whether it's the corporal or whether it's the children.
Okay. The plural of anecdote is not data. So Nancy Pelosi's anecdotes matter. The two children who perished in CPB custody.
And actually, they did. I mean, one died at the hospital and whatever.
Right. Okay.
They were sick before they arrived in this country, and the sickness was exacerbated by the long journey. No one ever talks about that.
Her anecdotes matter of children who died with, but not at the hands of violent criminals, or, as far as we know, negligent conduct by federal employees or medical professionals.
Right.
Those anecdotes matter. Ranil Singh dying at the hands of a person in this country illegally who murdered him, who killed him, shot him, that doesn't matter. Oh, and by the way, Nancy, you just heard data from Ted Cruz from 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, and we've got more data for you. It is wholly disingenuous, the position of the left on the score of human pain, the sentimental, barbaric position that the left is taking. And Sean Hannity, by the way, to his credit, he assembled family members of victims murdered, killed, whether manslaughter, a DUI, or first or second degree murder by persons in this country legal. Nine family members represented on Hannity's program the other night. Listen to the rundown.
Wendy and DJ Corcoran, their son Pierce, 22 years old, was just killed this past December 29th by a suspected illegal immigrant in Knoxville. He was driving on the wrong side of the road, wrong side of the highway. 22 years old. We're also joined by Laura Wilkinson. Her son Joshua was beaten and strangled and set aflame on fire by a classmate who was in this country illegally. Joshua was 18 years old. Then we have Steve Ronnebeck, his son Grant, who's raising money for college. He worked overnight in a convenience store, shot by an illegal immigrant robbing the store where Grant was working overnight, the midnight shift. Agnes Gibney is also with us. Her son, Ronald Da Silva, was shot in a driveway by an illegal immigrant gang member who had previously been deported. And let's introduce Michelle Root. Her daughter, Sarah, was killed by an illegal immigrant who was drunk driving, and he disappeared after posting bail. Why did he get bail? We're also joined by Marianne Mendoza. Her son, Police Sergeant Brandon Mendoza, was killed by a drunk driver in the country illegally, an immigrant in a head-on collision. Also with us, Maureen Maloney. Her son, Matthew. Denise was literally killed by an illegal alien who was drunk driving. And lastly, we introduce Sabine Durden. Her son, Dominic, was killed in a collision by an illegal immigrant who had two prior DUI convictions, and Dominic was a 911 dispatcher.
Not data. Not data. Those anecdotes don't matter. That's the Pelosi position. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Brian McCann. He's affiliated with Advocates for Victims of Illegal Alien Crime, AVIAC, and also a family member, his brother, Denny, killed on the streets of Chicago by a person in this country illegally. Brian, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Dan and Amy. Glad to be here.
So some people are probably familiar with your brother's story, in part because we've talked about it in this show before. John Cass has written about it in the Tribune. But for those who aren't, please refresh or inform our understanding.
Sure. 2011, up in Logan Square, in the shadow of General Logan's statue up there, he was crossing Kedzie Avenue to call on a client who owned a Mexican restaurant. And they were good friends, and as he was crossing Kedzie Avenue, a drunk driver, prior convicted drunk driver from Mexico, hit him and dragged him a little over a block, and he died violently. The offender was apprehended by an off-duty cop, and he was arraigned, and we were assured by the state's attorney that he would be prosecuted and serve 6-8 years in prison. When asked about his posting bond, they assured us that that would not happen because a federal detainer was issued, and he would not be allowed to. Well, what we didn't know at the time was that former Commissioner Garcia with his buddy Preckwinkle, President Preckwinkle, were in the process of hatching an ordinance in the council in the Cook County to pass an ordinance to make Cook County sanctuary. We weren't aware of that, nor was the prosecutor, by the way. And three, 4 months later, his brother posted the $25,000 bond, and my brother's killer is alive and well in Mexico, and the FBI hasn't told me anything in the last 2 years, so I'm assuming he's still down there. They said he was driving a truck, and they know where he lived, but they, for some odd reason, couldn't get him extradited.
Do you know how he got to this country illegally?
No.
But you do know, and they know where he's living currently.
That's what he told me. Each major metropolitan area has a fugitive unit. So the head of the fugitive unit there told me that they know where he lives, and he's driving a truck. But there's some machinations between the State Department and getting them to act on extradition and serving warrants. I guess that's a big thing, getting them to actually serve the warrant. There was a warrant issued by the Mexican authorities, but they won't serve it. Now, why, I don't know. I prevailed on the Honorable Dick Durbin, and he assured me to look into it, and I never heard anything from him.
Hold your breath.
So Brian, you were a teacher in Chicago, and both in CPS as well as private school, lived on the South Side. What's your perspective on this discussion, both locally with the sanctuary city, county, state status, as well as what you see going on nationally?
Well, I, of course, want the federal government to pass legislation to prohibit sanctuary cities, and I've always supported what Trump and Sessions and others, Cruz, have supported to withhold funding. That seems to be the only real stick that would work. Now, that's tied up in the courts right now, and my guess is it's going to wind up with the Supremes probably this session, and hopefully we'll win there now that we have a majority. The sanctuary issue is not at all being discussed of late because the wall seems to be the dominant, which I support all of the conservative positions on the wall, too. But the sanctuary argument doesn't seem to be getting any
attention.
Well,
what do you say
right
to
now?
The federal workers who are upset that they haven't had a paycheck, but you know, realize why President Trump is doing this?
I was talking to my wife this morning. I worked for the Department of Dependent Schools in 1987 and I took a year off from CPS, and I didn't get paid for 3 months. I was living in southwestern Germany, Karlsruhe, teaching Army brats, and I finally got my back pay. I had to borrow money from my now deceased brother to get through. But you know, they'll get paid. I have no particular worries about their issue at all. They'll be taken care of. In fact, legislation was passed just the other day that was sure that they'll get back pay. So I have no particular worry about them.
How do you react to a Nancy Pelosi statement that stories like yours, two stories like yours, the plural of anecdote is not data?
Yeah, well, Anna, you know, she's the symbol of the enemy, and I'm not so sure beating up her or Schumer is works. The Hannity thing the other night was good. You know, I knew virtually all of those people, and I've been with them in D.C. before. But I just wonder if this, you know, and a couple of my people were slashing. One of them, Marianne, who used to be with us, she's no longer. I guess she confronted Pelosi, and Pelosi said she'd pray for her. I mean, he's kind of. I mean, I guess he's a good human interest. Stories, but you know, just beating up her. She's kind of a pathetic figure that needs to retire. I mean, she's a grandma. She should go back to her big villa in the valley in California and just go away. We've got to figure out a better way to go at this. I just don't know what the answers are. I see Lindsey Graham yesterday. He failed in his attempt to get Trump to do something, and somebody's got to broker this. I really don't know the answers.
Do you think maybe that, you know, because people react to stories, that's how they can maybe understand more complicated issues. Do you think, like what Hannity did, elevating these stories of real people and real families, maybe that's a way to break the logjam?
Yeah, I don't want to be cynical, but I think we helped Hannity's ratings more than they helped the cause. I'm becoming very cynical about cable television, to be honest.
Okay.
I think they won't accept any invitations from them anymore. I've turned them down. They use us. It's a ratings game. Cable television, I think, is the ruin of America. I really do.
Well, I mean, it's generally hard to disagree with that. But I mean, so forget the venue. What about the idea of elevating your stories? I mean, that's what the left is doing. That's what Nancy Pelosi is doing. She makes reference to the two children who died, you know, essentially in federal government custody. Those stories of real human stories, your family story, the others, they matter. So shouldn't they be amplified?
Absolutely. And Kristen, mispronounce her last name, the Secretary of Homeland
Nielsen,
Security. She's
got
excellent data that's been put in the paper. You know, the general public, I think what probably needs to be done and isn't done is the NewsHour, public television, and the major CBS, ABC, NBC, the 6 o'clock news, 5:30 news, they're not reporting it very well. So the left gets Fox, we get Fox on the right, they get those other two stations on the left, and the public is really misinformed. I now live out here in the western suburbs. You walk up and down the street, people are clueless. They have no idea how serious the situation is. But they do know about the poor children on the border. They get that. We're just not messaging very well, and that's why I started this organization with some other people. We're trying, but it's just not working. I don't know. The general public has to get on board. It certainly worked in the Vietnam War.
Brian, where can people get more information about your organization, AVAC, Advocates for Victims of Illegal Alien Crime?
The website is avac.us. The website is up and running, and it's being reconstructed at the time, but you can we've got our information on there and the biographies, and there's a button for donation too, because to help defray the cost when we go to Washington. And you can always read my book, Death in Chicago, a Sanctuary City. That'll give you a little more information on the specific dilemma that I went through in 2012 and 13, being lied to by county commissioners and others. If I can only take a moment as an aside, Denny was a big fan of Milton Friedman.
Oh,
he introduced me, who was a public sector worker, to Milton many years ago. Remember Milton had that TV series? I forgot.
Free to Choose, yes.
There you go. And Denny was also a big fan of, who's the black economist?
Thomas Sowell.
Denny, you know, he was an insurance broker. So he and I used to have a lot of debates about the public versus private sector. In the end, he won because I support the private sector more than ever.
There you go. Brian McCann, the website aviac.us, the book.
Aviac.us, yeah.
Aviac.us, the book Death in Chicago. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate thanks so much, you guys. Yeah. All right, bye-bye.
And we think about you often, and your brother, too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. MLK birthday tomorrow, and the MLK Day, the day of observance, is a week from today, right?
Yeah, Monday. 21st. Which I can't stand that the kids don't have school. They should be in school that day learning about Martin Luther King Jr. I've always maintained that. It's just dumb for them to be out.
Well, I mean, you can learn about Martin Luther King and others on the rest of the days in the school year, too. But that's,
well,
you know.
Don't get me started.
Okay.
I lived in Arizona when they didn't observe the day, and it did not end well.
I understand that. A little perhaps taking stock then of what the civil rights era has begotten, now some 60 years removed. Also, the continued importance, of course, of Martin Luther King's work and legacy. But we had this conversation with Shelby Steele several weeks back before Christmas, and he helped me crystallize something I wasn't thinking about right. In terms of what we talk about a lot, which is messaging to constituencies that otherwise don't affiliate with, say, free market policies in terms of how they vote, even though these would be beneficial. He said, you have to understand, this is Steele, essentially, I'm sort of synthesizing what he said. He said, you know, we're sort of beyond the civil rights era in terms of certainly de jure segregation. We still have problems with de facto segregation, and that's certainly the case in Chicago. And so when the appeal is about sort of social justice, like the left does, too many on the center right try to offer the same appeal. I'm not racist either. Rather than offering what so many black families concentrated in urban centers have not had, which is pathways to economic opportunity. It's one of the reasons school choice programs have become so popular and are shifting the balance of political power in states like Florida. Remember, we remarked upon Ron DeSantis nearly winning the Florida governor's race. 44% of the Latino vote, 14% of the black vote. His percentage of the black vote was up, I think, 4 percentage points over Rick Scott from 4 years earlier. And those who know on the ground in Florida suggest that, yeah, the more than 500,000 scholarship families, opportunity scholarship families, able to send their children to better schools because of those scholarships, disproportionately lower income, disproportionately minority, have created a constituency for the Republican Party in Florida. And to some extent, Latinos have done the same for Republicans in Arizona. And so it should inform the thinking about how to approach people who have written you off for the last 50 years, which would be my way of saying how the Republicans should approach black families, at least in part. But for more of this, I wanted to bring in much more of an expert on the topic than I. He is our friend Walter Williams, His Eminence, the great professor of economics from George Mason University, syndicated columnist, and his most recent piece is where I want to start. the worst enemy of black people. Professor Williams, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So who is the worst enemy of black people today?
Well, I guess you could compartmentalize it and say, well, black people themselves, and then the white liberals who have advocated various programs, handout programs by government that has, the welfare state has done to black Americans what slavery could not have done, what Jim Crow and all the racism could not have done, and that is destroy the black family. That is, it turns out that nationally, 75% of black kids are born to unwed mothers. And in some cities, such as your own and others, you're talking about 80 or 85%. And in 1938, for example, the illegitimacy rate among blacks was 11% compared to 75% of today. And illegitimacy among whites was 3% compared to roughly 30% today. And so a major problem with black Americans is the liberal agenda that supports this kind of lifestyle. And it turns out that that the worst problems that blacks suffer are self-imposed. That is, it's not the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council that's going around and getting 16, 17, 18-year-old girls pregnant. It's not the White Citizens Committee or the Ku Klux Klan riding through Chicago and shooting up, I think last year, close to 500 people. And matter of fact, some of the most horrible conditions that black Americans suffer under are in the very cities that have been under Democrat control for over a half century.
Right. Well, what do you think of community leaders such as Reverend Jesse Jackson? Do you think he's helped his community, or is he keeping, you know, the black man down? What do you think?
Well, I think that his ideas and what he's been promoting, the liberal agenda, has been very harmful to black kids, black people in general. You know, just the whole notion, you know, people are talking about the education. And I've often said that if I were the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan and I wanted to sabotage any kind of chance for academic excellence among black kids, I couldn't think of a better method than the public school system in most cities where blacks many times have a high school diploma in hand and they cannot read and write and compute at the sixth grade level. And that's a fraud. And that kind of fraud rests solely on the education establishment. That is, the education establishment will say, well, look, there's parental problems, there's crime in the streets, and et cetera, that handicaps black kids learning. But they have the sole power to issue a diploma. That is, and when they issue a diploma that attests that a kid can read and write at a 12th grade level, when in fact he cannot read at the 5th and 5th and 6th and 7th grade level, that is just academic fraud. And black people have tolerated that.
In your piece that I referenced at the outset of this segment, you invoke the words of Malcolm X, who's an iconic black figure to many on the left, particularly the Spike Lees of the world, made a movie about him. And it seems perhaps that you're suggesting that so many who invoke Malcolm X are misunderstanding the position or the legacy of Malcolm X. It wasn't to be a black separatist. It was to be a problem solver. That seems to be at least in part what you're indicating. Is that fair?
That is absolutely right. That is what Malcolm X was. Part of his message was that that white liberals cannot solve black people's problem, and I just gave you a couple examples of the rotten education that black kids are receiving and the illegitimacy rate That is, white liberals cannot solve that problem. And matter of fact, if anything, white liberals have given rise to the problem. That is, they've given the welfare state. They promoted the welfare state that encourages young girls to have babies out of marriage. White liberals tolerate the gross violence in schools. That is, where 5% of the nation's 3.8 million teachers were assaulted in 2016, and many blacks, including ex-President Obama, they want to stop schools from being able to suspend kids that are violent and unruly. That is, they call it. They want to break the high school to prison chain, they say. But the kind of things that are being tolerated by today's black people just would not have been tolerated years ago. I'm almost 83, and the kind of things that are tolerated in schools would have never been tolerated when I was a youngster in schools.
Such as talking back to teachers. I mean, I was a substitute teacher.
Assaulting them, too.
I mean, it's bad. It feels like a war zone in there.
That's right. And several teachers in Chicago, I did a column some time ago, where there are many Chicago teachers suffering from post-traumatic syndrome. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get your take because you're a renowned economics professor as well. Bill de Blasio made an important statement to give you an indication of where we're at in terms of our political landscape in announcing his plan for New York City to provide health insurance to all of its residents, basically single payer at the local level. And he said, brothers and sisters, and that's important too, almost religious, brothers and sisters, there is plenty of money in the city. It's just in the wrong hands. Your reaction?
Well, I think he and other mayors, they've engaged in policies that have run out the most productive city people in their cities, and calling for higher taxes, imposing higher taxes on the most productive people. And the most productive people didn't become productive by being stupid. He runs them out of the city. You know, if you look at, if you look at population declines in cities like Baltimore and Detroit, you know, population has fallen by 2/3 since 1950 in Detroit and Baltimore, and a lot of the reason for that is that you had Coleman Young in Baltimore trying to provide free lunches and imposing heavy taxes and restrictions on people, and they just ran them out of the city. And so what happens is that the city loses its tax base, and so has raised taxes even more, and then they lose more of their tax base.
He is Walter Williams, a professor of economics at George Mason University, syndicated columnist. His website, if you want to get all of his musings on various topics, WalterEWilliams.com. WalterEWilliams.com is the website. Professor Williams, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
And thank you for inviting me. Goodbye.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, just following on our conversation with the great Walter Williams, George Mason University, Stacey Abrams, talking a little bit about Martin Luther King birthday tomorrow, Martin Luther King Day of Remembrance a week from today.
Yep.
So we're talking with him about sort of the state of the black family in America from a lot of different perspectives. Margaret Hoover interviewed Stacey Abrams, that Democrat nominee for governor in Georgia that narrowly lost that gubernatorial race.
And the support of Oprah and others.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The question was about letting non-citizens vote. Listen to this exchange.
What is your view about some municipalities like San Francisco who have decided that it's okay for some non-citizens to vote in local elections?
I think there's a difference between municipal and state and federal. Part of a municipality, I'm not arguing for or against it, but I will say, having been deputy city attorney, there's the granularity of what cities decide is so specific as to I think, allow for people to be participants in the process without it somehow undermining our larger democratic ethic that says that you should be a citizen to be a part of the conversation.
So not in some cases you would be supportive of non-citizens voting?
I wouldn't oppose it.
See, this is what the left does. The way to correct fraud is to legalize it and institutionalize it. And it's the exact same thing they're doing with respect to illegal immigration in this country. The way you deal with it, normalize it, institutionalize it, because it's to their political advantage to do so, they believe.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5, on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So the breaking news, Chiron-worthy New York Times story over the weekend after Trump fired Comey, the FBI initiated a counterintelligence investigation into Trump to determine whether or not he was operating as a Russian agent.
Yeah, they went so far as to call him a possible Russian spy. And then the headline, too, is President working on behalf of Russia? Is he an operative? Is he a spy? And they pointed to the fact that when he met with Putin, he had his interpreter's notes destroyed or took them from her. So, I mean, that is not any part of the proof to me. But President Trump went out with Judge Jeanine.
Are you now or have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked. I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written. And if you read the article, you'd see that they found absolutely nothing.
And Lindsey Graham was on with Chris Wallace on Sunday, Fox News Sunday yesterday. He was asked about that report as well. And not only is he rejecting it, as the president did, he wants some answers as to how it was initiated.
I have to say, it's an astonishing idea. The FBI, the Bureau, investigating whether the president was a Russian agent.
Well, number one, that story came from somebody who leaked it with an agenda. So I'd like to know who leaked it, because they have an agenda not very friendly to President Trump. And I, for one, don't trust what I read in the New York Times. Having said all that, I'm going to ask the FBI director, was there a counterintelligence investigation opened up regarding the president as being a potential agent of the Russians? I find it astonishing. And to me, it tells me a lot about the people running the FBI, McCabe and that crowd. I don't trust them as far as I throw them. So if this really did happen, Congress needs to know about it. And what I want to do is make sure, how could the FBI do that? What kind of checks and balances are there?
For more on this topic.
So absurd, isn't it?
Why don't we ask Jed Babin, okay. Former United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, contributor to the Washington Times, the American Spectator. Jed, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning, guys.
Morning. So is President Trump Raymond Shaw, a Manchurian candidate?
The Democrats only wish he were. Look, it's absurd. And, you know, the real big trouble to this, and Lindsey Graham went through a whole string of things before he got to the real problem here. If you can't trust the FBI, who in America and the world can you trust? Right now, we can't trust the FBI. This is an enormous scandal. It's an enormous problem. And the new Attorney General, Bill Barr, if he gets confirmed, will have to go in there and clean house. A lot of the people who were the problem, Peter Strzok, Andrew McCabe, James Comey, the worst of all, a lot of those people have been either fired or retired. But at this point, what other people, we don't know what other people were involved. But this goes back to the old Stalinist era, Lavrenty Beria, the head of the NKVD at the time, the Russian secret police. Mm-hmm. You know, he was saying, well, show me the man and I'll show you the crime. That's the problem. In a democracy, you cannot have investigations unless someone points to evidence of a crime. And what you have here is precisely the opposite. You have the Lavrenty Beria approach, going to find a person, you know, identifying the person you don't like, and then trying to find a crime that they've committed. This is undemocratic. It's a crime against our system of government and against the Constitution.
Well, how optimistic are you that with perhaps with the new head at the Department of Justice, new Attorney General in William Barr, that some of those concerns you're describing would be addressed?
Come on, guys. You know me. I'm the world's ultimate pessimist. Right. Look, Bill Barr, I think, is I don't know him, but I think from what I've heard, he's a very good and honorable man. But he is a big friend of Bob Mueller. They have been lifelong friends. Their wives hang out together. I don't think anybody is going to be in a position, well, certainly Bill Barr is not going to be in a position, to rein in Bob Mueller and to get to the bottom of what's wrong with the FBI. I think you need someone in there who is, well, more like a John Kelly, a Marine general, to whip things into shape than you are going to find with any civilian and anybody who is, you know, part of the legal community in Washington, D.C.
You just mentioned somebody who said if he gets confirmed, do you think that's a possibility that he won't?
I don't think there's a real possibility there, Amy. I think he's going to get confirmed. I think it's going to be like everything else these days. It's going to be a very ugly confirmation process. The Democrats are going to try to make him say that he's not going to fire Robert Mueller. There's going to be a whole lot of posturing and hammering, and I think there's not going to be much come of it. I think he will be confirmed.
All right. You wrote a piece in The Spectator about Theresa May and Brexit. Theresa May, if Theresa May is Cleavon Little, as you suggest, then who is Trump in this remake of Blazing Saddles?
Well, I don't know. I think Trump is kind of like the mayor who's standing there and trying to read a proclamation and declaring a laurel and hearty welcome, which is a really bad pun. Look, Blazing Saddles is and was the funniest movie ever made. It's my favorite movie in the world. But if you look at what Theresa May did last month, she took herself prisoner like Sheriff Bart did. I mean, this woman went out to the European Union and said, well, if you guys don't give me changes to the separation agreement, I'm going to hold a vote right away. And, of course, she was going to lose the vote. And they just said, yes, so. I mean, it's ridiculous. Remember the scene in Blazing Saddles where Cleavon Little takes himself prisoner?
Yeah.
When he goes into town and all the racists meet him and start threatening him, pointing guns at him.
Nobody
moves
over
his own gun.
Yeah, right.
And points it at his own head. I mean, that's Theresa May. It's ludicrous. She is probably the most incompetent prime minister in memory than the prime minister of Great Britain. And I think she's going to go down. Her government's probably going to go down. They're going to lose the vote tomorrow. It's scheduled for a big up or down vote on her Brexit separation agreement. And at that point, I think she's probably going to be kicked out of office in high bloody time.
Well, she said she's not going to stand for re-election in 2020. I mean, I guess there's
yeah,
always
that. She's not going to last that.
Yeah,
not going to last that long. Good God.
So George Will, writing in National Review, referenda delenda est, referenda must be destroyed. Remembering my high school Latin, essentially what he's suggesting is that the exuberance of 2016 is going to go out with a whimper in 2019. Is that what you think is going to happen and should happen?
Well, I think it might happen. I don't think it should happen. I think Britain, to recover itself from the, you know, frankly, the anti-democratic practices and the encroachment of the European Union, it needs to get out of the European Union. It needs to recover its sovereignty. However, it's even money as to whether that's even going to happen. Theresa May is now saying, she said yesterday, that if the vote fails on her Brexit agreement tomorrow, and I think it's 90%, 95% sure that it will, she's going to say, well, you know, we may not want to do Brexit at all. She may try to cancel the Brexit vote. And I think the European Union has said she can. And quite frankly, all it would take is, well, either a declaration by her, which I don't think is adequate under British law, or she could get the Parliament to pass something that says no Brexit. So there's a lot of things that have not been answered yet. And it's great political theater. I mean, we have to watch with some concern because Britain is, after all, a pretty important ally. But at this point, not a damn thing we can do.
Should we be watching with some concern the apparent disagreement between John Bolton and President Trump over the exact manner in which there'll be a troop drawdown in Syria?
Yeah, we have to figure that out. Trump and Pompeo and Bolton all have to figure that out. Look, we've had Mr. Trump saying yesterday, first off, Erdogan, Turkey's president, has been saying he's going to kill all the Kurds as soon as we leave. Bolton has said that he can't do that. We're going to be in Syria as long as Iran is. Trump is pulling people out nevertheless. Pompeo is standing up there and saying, well, we're not going to put up with Iran. there's a mixture of opinion, obviously, in the White House and the administration on what the policy towards Syria and toward Iran and toward the Middle East needs to be. I don't think there's a lot of agreement, but I do think that Mrs. Bolton and Pompeo have the right idea. Trump said the other day that, well, yesterday, that if Kurds are attacked by Turkey, we're going to wreck the Turkish economy. Well, that's not enough, Mr. President. We have to tell Erdogan that if he tries to attack the Kurds, we're going to attack him. And it has to be put in those terms or, you know, there's no other way to stop this guy.
Then he also,
I think he is. Sorry. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. He also talked about creating a 20-mile safe zone. What's that?
Yeah, it's kind of a pipe dream. There's Syria is not that big, guys. I mean, the area around Syria that's probably Kurdistan or Kurdish territory, mm-hmm. So northeast Syria, southeast Turkey, and northern Iraq. That's, I don't think there's 20 miles there altogether. So I think there's, you know, that's an idea. I don't think it's going to happen. We're not going to be creating no-fly zones over there. We don't have the people or the time to create it. So I think that's kind of a throwaway line.
Last week, Secretary of State Pompeo, delivering a speech in Cairo, declared that the era of America's self-inflicted shame is over, gave a pretty devastating review of the last decade of American foreign policy in the region, the Obama administration era policy in the region. I wonder what marks you gave Pompeo's speech.
A+. That was the best foreign policy speech been given in Trump's time as president or even before when he was running. This is the most clear-headed and really best statement of what American policy should be. Whether it's going to be American policy remains to be seen because Mr. Trump, God love him, but he kind of dips his finger in the pie once in a while, and there's no consistency to what he says. So we need to have that kind of guidance, like Mr. Pompeo's speech, guiding our foreign policy in the Middle East. It remains to be seen what effect it's going to have. I'm not sure it's going to have much.
I thought so, too. I thought the speech was excellent. So if I'm thinking like Jed Babin, then I know I'm in the right place. He is Jed Babin.
Scary, isn't it?
Former. Well, we love, both like love Blazing Saddles, too. I went to a screening
well,
of it.
Go.
I went to a screening of it a couple years ago with Mel Brooks, where he
really?
Then does an hour show after the screening.
I am so jealous.
Oh, it was the best.
Did he ever
so
say
jealous.
That the movie could be made in this time?
He says absolutely not.
Oh, God, no.
Absolutely
oh, no
not.
Way.
Gosh.
I mean,
no way.
The racist slurs and all the rest of that stuff. It's, you know, people don't understand that the principal purpose of the movie was to put down racism, to show how really stupid it is.
Yes.
But right now, I mean, political correctness and all the rest of that, you couldn't remake that movie. I mean, as Mel Brooks himself has said, political correctness is killing American comedy.
Yeah, there's no room for parody. Jed Babin, former United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, contributor to The Washington Times and The Spectator. Jed, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, Dan, today is the day. Are you heading to Springfield at 9 o'clock just to get down there to see our 43rd governor of Illinois sworn in?
No.
Before the masses?
No, I'm not. No. So it's going to be JB and MK?
Yeah, so JB and MK yesterday were...
So it's Jelly Belly, and then MK is his wife, Money Keeper? What does that stand for?
I like that, Money Keeper.
Jelly Belly and Money Keeper, your first family.
They're the old state capitol yesterday, welcoming visitors. There was a line of people snaked around the building to get to meet them, to congratulate him. And one person in line, and believe it or not, he was in line. I don't know if he was cutting, but Dick Durbin talking about the challenges that JB's going to face.
The toughest thing, of course, is dealing with the reality of a legislature that is co-equal under our state constitution, and he has to find a way to work with them. And that means cooperation, compromise, and I think he can do it.
I'm confused. Isn't the majority of legislatures Democratic? There's
supermajorities.
The supermajority. Oh, I'm sorry. Now there's a majority, supermajority. So what is Dick Durbin talking about? Has he lost his mind?
No, it's just a typical typical civics pablum you get from a Dick Durbin, pretending that there's something other than a cabal in charge, that they're not all part of the same ruling class. The only disagreements are going to be how much do you want to increase taxes? How far left do you want
to
go?
Well, he's trying to minimize increasing taxes because this is his vision for the future. Just take a deep breath. Ready? Raising the minimum wage, legalizing recreational marijuana, allowing sports betting as a ways to help people and the state get on firmer financial footing.
Gambling, dope, and big government. That's what we do in Illinois. If you think that's if you think that's a recipe for a growing state, then apparently you're not paying attention, or you have no understanding of what those three things portend. So Dick Durbin, J.B. Pritzker, but let me tell you something.
Yeah.
He's not going to get pushback from the super minority Republicans either. You see the vote to increase agency heads' pay last week, 15%, supported by super minority leader Jim Durkin in the House, super minority leader Bill Brady in the Senate, advocated for by both of those within their caucuses. So amid $250 billion in debt, the worst governed state in the country, in American history, I would argue, you have Republican legislative leaders who've learned nothing from what happened in November, just folding in with Jelly Belly and Moneykeeper and Madigan and Cullerton to advance their flag. And that's what you're going to see for the next 4 years in Illinois. And that's why you may want to be in contact with a real estate agent.
Yeah, well, who's going to be in charge? Mike Madigan? Answer the question, JB.
Oh, I'll be in charge as governor of the state of Illinois. I'm going to work with the legislature, with the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House. I'm sure that there will be disagreements over time.
Good luck to you.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and so I asked the question before Mike Scott's news. Why the sudden law enforcement interest in longtime creep R. Kelly? And I really mean that. These allegations against R. Kelly that were in part profiled on what, Lifetime?
Yeah, it was a Lifetime documentary called Surviving R. Kelly.
And we're unfamiliar with these with respect to...
And it took place to, you know, apparent places where he was stashing girls in Fulton County, Georgia, but also here in Chicago, in particular, allegedly at his West Side recording studio, which on Friday, a judge ruled that city inspectors can go in that building, but they can't go in there until Wednesday. And they don't like what they're seeing so far from the outside. Here is Inspector David Trejo.
A couple of windows have been bricked up that were existing windows prior. And a lot of security on the building.
They also say that there's padlocks now on the dumpsters outside his West Side studio, so nobody can even go through the garbage.
If someone is living there and the property has not been converted properly to living space, it could create a safety concern if a fire breaks out, there could be a number of things that can go wrong.
I think you're missing the forest fire for the trees.
No.
I mean, so here's the deal. I have a friend who's got a friend who has a building next to R. Kelly's on the West Side. He says he regularly sees girls being shuttled in and out of the building. There have been a lot of complaints about the goings-on for neighbors, the goings-on at the building from neighbors for years. Nothing was ever done about it. Where's Alderman Burnett been? Walter Burnett's ward. Where's Walter Burnett? Where's Kim Fox? Where's Enid Alvarez before him? I mean, a decade ago, when he was on trial for raping a girl. Underage.
Underage.
Video. Not me on the video defense. Okay, worked. I saw him come into a fight night with his entourage. I've mentioned this story before. And, I mean, the girl on his arm, I don't know how old she was. I didn't ask. But, I mean, I would be surprised if she was 18.
Really?
I would be not surprised if she was more like 15 or 16. I mean, so all of a sudden now, and I mean, I guess it's better late than never, but now there's an interest because Lifetime did a special on it?
Yeah, because six of the episodes were that building was featured on that docuseries. And besides your friend, Melanie Rowland lives on the other side of the studio.
We see a lot of traffic coming in and out.
There you go.
We see young girls, sometimes older girls, parents dropping them off, Ubers, cabs, limousines come, a bunch of girls jump out, you know, run in there screaming.
I'm guessing those are not all aspiring recording artists.
No.
That's the point.
And then on Friday night, two people called 311 and said that Kelly was holding two women against their will in his Trump Tower condo. Police officers interviewed Kelly and the woman, but they found no evidence of wrongdoing, and she was of age.
And again, there have been allegations against him here as well as in Atlanta, at least.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there were stories about him essentially holding women hostage. He wasn't hiding in a closet. He was locking, to borrow from R. Kelly's work,
right.
He was locking them in one, apparently.
Exactly.
And I don't mean to make light of it, but I just, so my point is some accountability for what was widely known and what was ignored by your alderman, by your Cook County State's Attorney, by, again, the people in charge with responsibility. I mean, it's so interesting to me how reticent we are, particularly in Chicago, just stick here, to go after high-profile people.
I know. And then Kim Fox, who rarely, I mean, she doesn't hold a lot of press conference, held what I thought was a kind of bizarre press conference asking for people to come forward, asking for witnesses to come forward, or if anyone's been held against their will by R. Kelly.
And now we have, localities that are trying to banish R. Kelly because they don't want any of the R. Kelly stink or scrutiny. So, right?
Yeah, I don't know if you're planning on going to Springfield in April, but
no.
It's called Spring Break Jam. Because Springfield, it's lovely in April. I mean,
sure.
Which sunscreen are you going to wear? SPF 50 or 8? I don't know.
Yeah, you'll get to see J.B. Pritzker wearing one of his designer T-shirts and jam shorts.
But the Illinois Department of Agriculture, Dennis Albert, told the Tribune that the application for the Spring Break Jam in April has been denied, Dan, because of security concerns following, protests out of the studio. And then basically, I don't know if they think that he might show up.
Because of security concerns.
Really,
because
no, because he's a...
PR concerns.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why don't they just say that? Security concerns. Not going to happen.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so... some families in some of the poorer communities in Cook County, not waiting for Godot anymore. They're going Galt. We'll get to Fort Heights in a little bit, but conversation about property taxes again. Home values. Remember, Chicago, projected by Realtor.com, to be number 200 of the top 200 metropolitan markets in the country for home prices in 2019. And I know the reaction is, this is great, and we want more of the same. I saw the election results, so I hear you. Okay. Kenny Norman, Illini great. Remember Kenny Norman?
Kenny.
The snake.
Oh, yeah, Kenny Norman.
He played in the NBA for a number of years, made like $21 million bucks over a 10-year career playing for the Clippers and the Bucks and the Hawks.
Good for him.
Yeah, great player. He also bought a home.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Ruh-roh.
Here's where it turns bad for Kenny Norman.
Play the music. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. He bought a home in unincorporated Rich Township in the south suburbs for $430,000 back in 1989. 7,000 square foot dream house.
Ooh. In Rich Township?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm shucking oysters over here.
Property's peak value was $1.35 million in 1999. It sold in October of last year. Remember the numbers, please.
Ooh. Okay.
Bought it for $430 in 89. Reached a peak property value of $1.35 in 99. And then the South Suburbs fell off the cliff.
Yeah.
Like the state is doing. The property sold on October 9th, 3 months ago, $182,000. In 2017, that property, $43,000 in property taxes.
That's giving it away. 7,000 square feet? 7,200 square feet? For $182,000?
2017, the property tax bill was $43,000.
For the year?
$43,000. Mm-hmm. The tax rate for the property, the tax rate for the property is 14.82% of property value, which is 14x the national average.
Ooh, did he get fleeced?
Not alone.
Ooh.
And so let's go to Fort Heights, the poorest community in Cook County.
Oh, my God.
One of the poorest communities in the country. Basically 100% African American. Reporting SouthCookNews.com. Facing astronomical bills and real estate that's now worthless at best, Fort Heights home and business owners have literally nothing to lose by ignoring them. Fort Heights families are leading the revolt that the well-heeled refuse to lead in places like the Western Burbs or the North Shore. Nearly 1,000 Fort Heights property tax bills totaling $2.3 million were not paid last year. That's in a village of 2,700 people, 987 households, 1,000 property tax bills, commercial and residential, 987 households, 729 residential properties, and then the commercial properties. To give you a perspective, $2.3 million over 1,000 property tax bills not paid. The village's total 2017 budget was $1.8 million. That is a full-on revolt.
Well, what do they do? They're just not paying, and then are they? Is the sheriff coming to kick them out of their house? Just doing what people do in Detroit, just literally
Tom Dart?
Leave the keys? You have the keys back into the mortgage company?
For what? Mortgage? For what? Who wants to take possession of those properties? They're worthless, at best. The 20 most expensive properties in Fort Heights amounted to $6.6 million in the collective property tax, collective property value, $1.1 million in property taxes due. 13 of those 20 bills have not been paid, totaling $700,000 of the $1 million in property taxes due. Who is current in their property taxes in town, Fort Heights? Family Dollar, the only retailer in town that doesn't sell liquor, and the Atlantis Gentlemen's Club.
They're up to
the top strip club, fourth highest tax bill in the town, after the garbage dump, an empty lot, and a Citgo station. Then you got the strip joint. Good times, huh? South Suburbs, Democrat stronghold. Bloom, Rich, Thornton Township. All your Democrat local leaders, all your Democrat state legislators, always voting for the Democrats in charge of the state. Destroyed. Destroyed. And it's now that cancer is metastasizing. Just thought you should know, because I know a lot of people with hate has no home here signs in their yards in places like Hinsdale and Kenilworth and Glencoe feign real concern for families that are not as fortunate as them. Feign concern.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
Take a couple calls on, I don't know, R. Kelly, Fort Heights, South Suburbs, property taxes, Illinois. Sean in Elmwood Park here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Come on, Prof, aren't you watching TV? What the hell are you worried about? The Democrats got our backs. Don't get nervous. They got the Crypt Keeper out there. He said everything's going to be peachy. Don't get nervous. And I know you're down about Jelly Belly taking over.
No, I'm not.
But look at the upside.
No, I'm not. I'm not down.
Look at the upside, baby. You got to look at the upside. 7 foot is stupid. He's taking JoJo the dog face boy in his new Carhartt jacket, and they're getting the hell out of there, the fraud that he was. Now, here's the nice thing. I haven't heard Pritzker's wife say boo. She just wants to wear Jimmy Choo's shoes and put on her Louis Vuitton shoehorn and shut up for 4 years. This is going to be a lot better.
No, there's a
lot
of that. She's a lovely lady.
There's a lot of that going on in the Pritzker family.
But here's the thing.
She's wonderful.
Sean, I don't know if you heard, but the First Lady of California, she doesn't want to be called First Lady because there's no doubt she's going to be the first partner. So we're wondering if MK is going to be the first partner or the First Lady of Illinois.
First course.
That's perfect because any twosome Newsom, he doesn't care who shows up, a dog, a plumber, he's in. So I think it's perfect to go with. And here's the other thing, Prof, you've got options, baby. Thanks to me, you've got options.
Yeah, all right, here we go.
Don't discuss his options on the air.
Here comes a Sean commercial. All right, go ahead.
Here's the thing. You are flexible. You understand you're the smartest son of a gun here. No wife.
I do understand.
No kids.
No wife.
You got a condo.
Yep.
You could always sectionate it. It's in Lake Point Tower.
Or Airbnb.
This is a big win for you.
Yeah.
Me and Amy, we got these anchors, these kids, we got wives and husbands. We're really, you know, we got a lot of problems going on. But here's the thing, Amy. If we do abandon the family, you know, if I take off and say forget it and I don't pay the kids, I don't pay the old lady, Pritzker now says she's virtuous and they'll take away from Prof to pay my wife. So let's look at the upside of socialism. If you're a bum, you're the virtuous one. So everybody could win. Just play the cards right. So they're a pair of twos. We could still win the hand.
Thanks for the call, Sean.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, our next guest. I'm sort of brought here on false pretenses, Amy.
What do you mean?
Because we're going to talk about his book, Less Oil or More Caskets. But what I really want him to do as a former mayor of Indianapolis, I want to bring him here. I want to keep him here. I want to force him to run for mayor of Chicago.
That's right.
Or some higher office here. We've implored former Governor Mitch Daniels, former Governor Mike Pence, Governor Eric Holcomb, so many people from Indiana who could either execute the order or have the influence to scramble the National Guard to have Indiana invade and take over Illinois, make it part of Indiana. Nobody's taken us up on it. So now that we have a Hoosier here, or as you call them, Indianans.
Okay, I made a mistake once, and I called you guys Indianans, and he won't let me live it down.
I haven't heard that for a while.
Yeah.
But you've heard it before, right? From a great mind, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. So usually the East Coast.
Exactly. He is Greg Ballard, former two-term mayor of Indianapolis, retired Marine Corps lieutenant colonel, who served 23 years in the Corps, including in the Persian Gulf War. And his book is Less Oil or More Caskets, The National Security Argument for Moving Away from Oil. Greg, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
So just lay out the thesis for your book.
Yeah, I actually couldn't have written the book 10 years ago. It's only when the technology of transportation started to change. And I was in the Persian Gulf War. People think I had an aha moment, but there was no aha moment to be had because we needed that. Everybody knew that at the time that the international economy, the global economy, needed that oil. That was Saddam Hussein was trying to get. So I started putting the numbers together my last couple of years as the mayor, and I thought, you know, what is this? What's oil used for? How can we do this? And is there a solution to all this? I'm just curious. And there was, because now 70% of the world's oil is used for transportation. And only very recently has the technology of transportation changed, how we fuel our cars can change. It's kind of staring us in the face. And that's so I started to look more into this and saw the numbers on all of this. 80% of the world's oil reserves are controlled by monarchs, if you will, OPEC and people who really control the supply of oil around the world. Just things like that. And with the new technology of cars and trucks, it seems almost too simple. But when you look at the numbers and look at what can be done, that it really is time to change. And so my motive about this, I'm very open about this, is I don't want our future military having to spend all that time in the Middle East, because the only reason we're in the Middle East is to protect the flow of oil. We took over from the British in the early 70s. We've been doing that for a long time now. It was part of our international security responsibilities. I understand that. It's just part of what we do. But I think we need to make oil not a critical strategic commodity in the world anymore. And I think we can do that right now because we spend, in 2017, we spent $81 billion. That's the latest figure, $81 billion to protect the flow of oil and infrastructure in the world with our troops.
Well, but there's the other side of the technology, the advances in technology, right, which is that it's projected that last year, the United States will be the biggest producer of crude in the world, surpassing Russia. Texas alone produces four times as much oil as Venezuela. So we're to a place where we can be energy independent, including with fossil fuels, which drive our economy at present, without having to rely on OPEC. I mean, we have more in Illinois. I was getting to just one other point. I mean, we have more inert energy and coal in southern Illinois than Saudi Arabia does oil. So oil and gas, I mean, how realistic is it that we're going to move away from oil and natural gas?
I think it's oil, coal, pretty realistic gas. Because I say in my book, and I've said it for years now, our energy independence is irrelevant. It just doesn't matter. If you're producing our oil, great, but we only own 2% of the world's oil reserves. We're not even in the top 10 of countries with oil reserves, so that's not going to play out by itself. But mainly, there's three things that will not happen, even if we do use our own oil. First of all, we will still have our troops in the Middle East protecting that oil. That's just what we do, right? Because oil is critical for the global economy. We make sure they do that. Terrorists will continue to be funded, even if we produce our own oil, completely, because two-thirds of the oil from the Middle East goes to Asia. Hundreds of billions of dollars from Asia goes to the Middle East. And the other thing is this enormous strategic leverage that these countries, Russia and OPEC, have over the rest of the world will not go away, even if we produce our own oil. Those three things will still be occurring. Our troops will still be over there. We'll still be spending hundreds of billions of dollars here in the near term to protect that flow of oil, and our troops will be over there, even if all the oil that we use in the country
is
protected.
But I don't think a lot of Americans know that most of our troops, their main job is to protect the flow of oil.
That's right. They don't know that. That is exactly right. And that's really a big reason why I wrote that book. Just recently, there's a group called Securing America's Future Energy in D.C. They have 14 four-stars, retired four-stars on there. They just came out with an article, quite Q&A type article a couple months ago. And they've been saying this for a long time now, but General Conway, former commandant of the Marine Corps, one of the questions he asked in there is, why does the United States protect the flow of oil from Iran to China? Really good question. He says, but we do. But that's our job. Another question in there says, we tell our troops we're over there protecting American interests.
Right.
But if you scratch that just a little bit, that comes up oil. And that's a retired four-star general saying that. We've known this for a long time. In my book, I referenced two war college papers, the best and the brightest going to war college, 2002, 2003, saying essentially this.
Well, so then what is that transition away from fossil fuels look like, and how does it proceed?
I'm only worried about the oil and the influence of the Middle East. I mean, that's what the book is about.
Okay.
I mean, the word green and sustainable and climate change is not in the book at all.
Okay.
That's not even in the book.
Okay.
Right? So, go ahead.
No. Go finish it yourself.
So, I'm concerned about the influence that these countries have over the rest of the world. I'm concerned that our troops are still over there protecting this critical strategic commodity when we now, and just recently, now have the technology that allows us to kind of move away from this.
You're talking about like electric cars.
Electric cars, right.
Yeah.
It can't change. It's not going to change tomorrow. But over the next 20 years, it certainly can change because the technology that's moving really quickly on this, and I don't know how much you follow this, but I kind of follow this every day.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the major countries around the world are saying we're not going to allow the sale of internal combustion engine cars past 2030 or 2035 or something. They're just not going to allow it to happen. So as a result, the car manufacturers are changing very, very quickly on this. I don't know if you've seen this. Ford is putting $40 billion into this. Chevy just came out and said, hey, we're doing this. We're going to lead this. All the German manufacturers are doing this. Most of China, which moves the car market, is doing this. I mean, so this is the part that I think we have an opportunity right here to change this.
Do you think anything that President Trump or his administration could do to help stop this?
Well, probably, but it goes to this really goes back to the 70s. In the presentation that I give regarding this, I go back and talk about all these presidents all the way back to Nixon, the oil embargoes of the 70s, and every president said this, 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 this. and even with the oil embargoes, our rate of our dependence on oil was 28% back in the 70s during the oil embargoes. It was actually 60% in 2006. Oh, really? Despite all the terrorist incidents, despite the Persian Gulf War, despite all these things that were horrible that were happening to us, we actually increased our dependence on foreign oil during all that time. Well, all these presidents, and I'm not after the presidents, don't get me wrong, but our federal government really is saying, hey, we're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this, just like we're saying right now, hey, we're producing more oil, this is all going to be fine. It's not going to all be fine. It's not.
Right, but some would argue that, look, I mean, we protect our strategic interests around the globe. I mean, so we're concerned about shipping lanes in the South China Sea, and we're concerned about oil production in quasi-friendly nations in the Middle East or North Africa, even as we're advancing in the direction I described earlier. And then the flip side is, you know, the challenge is, right, how cost-effective fossil fuel production is compared to some of these alternative energy sources, not just in terms of the cost to produce, but also, I mean, electric cars, this market exists largely because it's being subsidized by the federal and state governments. And it turns out to be the middle-income families subsidizing the rich when it comes to electric cars. So there's fairness issues in terms of policy with that.
The biggest energy subsidy in the world is that $81 billion or the oil industry. And I'm not after the oil companies.
Yeah, I don't want them to be subsidized either.
I don't want to mention them in my book at all either. But the biggest energy subsidy in the world is our protecting the flow of oil around the world. And in 2017, that was $81 billion. What our companies here get locally on the federal lands and everything, that break they get is huge. There's a lot of energy subsidies for the oil companies.
Yeah.
But they
should all go away. Would be my position.
Well, I get that.
Yeah.
But electricity is ubiquitous. It's absolutely everywhere. I plug my car in at night in the garage like you plug in a lamp or a hair dryer. I mean, and it trickles in overnight on my plug-in hybrids. That's what is here. And electricity is not subject to wild price swings like when Saudi Arabia decides to cut off the supply of oil. So there's a lot of stability involved in this. Most of our recessions have included an oil price spike just before. There's so many things to this, but you can't – I mean, I just don't think you can argue the fact that these countries have enormous influence over the rest of the world. They drive the market. There's no free market for oil. I don't know why people think there is. There is none. And that's what this is about. And I want to bring the troops home from the Middle East who are protecting that oil.
All right. Let's talk about your time in office as mayor of Indianapolis. Two terms.
Sure.
Did you leave with a budget surplus by any chance? Because we don't know what that's like here.
My successor.
Yes.
Was left more money than any mayor has ever been left with.
All right. How much?
It was between $130 and $150 million.
Oh, wow, Dan, that's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is nice. That must be why Indianapolis is a city on the come and is growing, and Chicago is a city on the wane and is dying.
And you're familiar with how many people from Illinois are moving to Indiana.
There are a few.
There's a few. There's somebody in our school in Chicago whose dad, they live in Indiana and drive to Chicago every day to go to school.
Well, it's like driving in from Northwest Indiana. It's like driving in from the suburbs.
Right, but I'm saying just because of the property taxes.
I understand. Yeah. There are companies that have moved from Illinois.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mitch used to really take advantage of all this. As you know, he came down pretty hard on Illinois quite a bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, not as hard as Illinois came down on itself. He was just sort of the beneficiary because he's our neighbor to the east. But, I mean, seriously, when you look, so you governed a substantial American city. When you look at what's happening in urban centers like Illinois, like Chicago, and others, Detroit's sort of on the rebound after reorganizing, but Baltimore, other mid-sized to large cities like Chicago. What's your impression?
I think a lot of the cities have gone through what I would call their troubling period with bad government, where they thought they could do everything. Other cities, and some of them have come out on the other side kind of successful. I knew the mayor of Philadelphia, the former mayor, Michael Nutter, pretty good. I think he was highly educated, great guy, really smart. And so I think they were kind of in good hands at that point in time. I don't think Detroit's coming back. I lived in Detroit for 3 years while I was the mayor, when Coleman Young was the mayor. And it was
Well, those are difficult times in Detroit. Yeah.
But that set them up for failure, right?
Yeah.
During all that.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were what they were doing. I think most cities have gone through that. Indianapolis really never had to go through that, which is great, and I hope it doesn't go through that. But we've never had to go through that that succession of government that wasn't responsive to what the needs of the city were. So there's a lot of that out there, and as you're seeing right now, it's pretty obvious right now, but we're a little bit more polarized than we have been in the past, and I think part of the problem is cities don't necessarily respond to what the Republican national ideology would be. There's a reason there's only two or three Republicans in charge of the top 25 cities in the country.
Yeah, is there even that many?
Well, for a long time, Indianapolis was the largest city
in
America with a Republican governor.
Yeah.
And then San Diego had a mayor, that Democratic mayor, who kind of did some horrible things. And,
remember
him. Yeah.
So they put a Republican governor in there, but a Republican mayor in there. But, it's just that I think Republicans have a ways to go in addressing cities and getting their message, which I think could be a very effective message, but I've told our senators this, and it's difficult to overcome the national ideology and some of the terminology that's used on the national level and bring it down to the city.
Fair point. He is Greg Ballard, former two-term mayor of Indianapolis, who this is another foreign concept here, self-term limited. He just decided 8 years was a good enough run, and I'm moving on.
And I love what you said, because you were all in and you had to take a break.
I was all in, and I would... I probably would have got elected again. My numbers were really high. But the citizens deserve somebody with full of energy, and it was all in. I don't think I could do another 4 years all in.
See, look at, he's honest, too.
Well, maybe, if you're looking, you're kind of nearing retirement, you want a new challenge to take on after the book, move up to Lakeview where Amy lives. And, 2023 is not that far away.
No.
Maybe a run,
This is a nice area right here.
We're going to do for Chicago what we did for Indianapolis. I think you'll have some people that will be supportive of that concept. Greg Ballard also, importantly, should mention, Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, served 23 years in the Corps. The book, Less Oil or More Caskets, The National Security Argument for Moving Away from Oil. And people can get this on Amazon.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Indiana University Press, who's the publisher.
Oh, great. Okay. Greg Ballard, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
You. Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word APP to 64636 to download the app today. AM 560 The Answer.
So poor Cody Parkey, or Corey Parkey, as you call him.
That's awful.
He was doing so well with his Today Show interview on Friday, sort of rehabilitating his image, introducing himself to the public as, this nice, God-fearing kid. But then Savannah Guthrie had to chime in. Here's Cody Parkey explaining what he was feeling when he missed that kick.
The reason you're here and the reason we're so excited to talk to you is because of the kind of person that you are and everything you did after that kick. But I have to ask you what you were thinking, what in that moment and in your mind, did you know it had been tipped? Like, what was going through your mind?
No, as a kicker, you live for those moments. And I was, like you said, I was 3 for 3 before that. I had a lot of confidence going into that kick. So I went out there and my long snapper and holder did a great job. Mm-hmm. And, I saw the wind moving a little bit. I said, all right, this is where I'm going to play it. And obviously I didn't know it was tipped or anything. I just went down and I thought I hit a pretty good kick, felt good off my foot, and then looking up, and then I saw it hit the upright, and then hit the crossbar, and I'm like, surely it'll go in.
Unfortunately,
bounced towards me, but I'm disappointed. That I let the fans, my teammates, and the whole organization down. But I'll continue to keep my head held high because football is what I do. It's not who I am.
Okay, good perspective. That's fair. But then Savannah Guthrie ruined it and turned the stomachs of Bear fans.
They have MVPs. I think they should have MHP, most honorable player.
Yeah,
you really.
Mom,
really,
you're embarrassing me. Stop.
Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773 467 5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.